Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. In fact, that book, The Finality of Jesus Christ, is not a long book, but it's a very important book. And if anybody will let the scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage, Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. You will discover there some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of Paul's epistle to the Romans. Let me, for a moment, review. We're in Romans chapter 1. We were last looking at verse 9. We have emphasized that the book of Romans is divided up into three, I would actually say four sections. The first eight chapters deal with the divine plan of salvation. Chapters 9 through 11 deal with the divine plan for Israel. Chapters 12 through 15, 13 deal with the divine prescription for Christian living. How should we then walk? And then the fourth section, chapter 15, 14 through 16, 27 to the end, are personal words to the Roman church, nevertheless relevant to us, as we shall see when we eventually get there, which will be quite a while. The introduction of the book is chapter 1 through verse 15. The salutation is chapter 1, verses 1 through 7. We're finished with the salutation. Now Paul goes ahead to share some very personal words with the Roman church. He begins with a thanksgiving to God through Jesus Christ for them because their faith is being proclaimed throughout the world, and there we highlighted a value system. It's not the way we measure churches today, is it? And that's sad. He had a spiritual metric, their faith, the strength of it, the tenacity of it, had captured the imagination of the Roman world. He explains to them in verse 9, for God, whom I serve in my spirit. He mentions that because he doesn't want anybody to think that he's just blowing smoke, that these words are pro forma. Very, very seriously, he calls God to bear witness to the fact that he's telling the absolute truth when he tells them that he is always in his prayers making request that if perhaps now, at last, by the will of God, I may proceed to come to you. But before that, We made note of the fact that he says, God, whom I serve in my spirit, that's a term of worship, in the preaching of the gospel of his son, and we were noting as the last program closed that it is kind of a habit today to distinguish between what we call worship and what we call preaching. And it gives worship leaders all kinds of trouble to try to figure out where to fit preaching into the rest of it, which they call a worship service. And their problem is the fallacy of trying to bifurcate those. As a matter of fact, the preaching of the word, the Spirit working through the word, is central to the whole worship exercise, as Paul's language suggests. He says he makes unceasing mention of you in prayer, always in my prayers making request, as I read earlier, and we'll drop that right there. What I want to call attention to in verse 9 is other language. God is my witness as to how unceasingly I make mention of you in my prayers. And that reminds us of 1 Thessalonians, where Paul tells us to pray without ceasing. Now, this may seem to some of you like kind of an idle point to waste words on, but it is not. There's a reason, and I'm going to explain it, why I stop here and have us take a look at that, how unceasingly I make mention of you. I remember when all through the 70s, but well before that, and seminary and other places where I was exposed to well-meaning teachers, they would come across language like that in their teaching, and they would lay a burden on students and others that should never have been laid there. As they were trying to promote, inculcate, kind of impel a prayer life, they would point to language like this, unceasingly I make mention of you in my prayers. Well, the natural thought that would occur to me, and did occur to me, and occur to many students that I heard, and I heard it redundantly, is that what Paul meant here by these words was an attitude of prayer. Now, I try to be a logical and reasonable human being, and I ask myself, look, unceasingly is 24/7, right? So it can't mean that. That should be obvious, and yet we have these people always saying that that means an attitude of prayer. We can't always be praying with words, but we can maintain an attitude of prayer 24/7. Well, I can't even do that. I'm sleeping for one-third or less of the day. Now, I'm not just picking at a pimple here. I will show you that this problem can be significant. There is no such thing, folks, as an attitude of prayer. There is no such thing as an attitude of speaking. Unless sometimes when you're trying to discipline a child and get it to shut up while you talk, we see in little Johnny or little Sally an intention to start talking and you don't want them to start talking. But you know what I mean. We're either praying or we're not praying. Hannah was praying with only her lips moving. She was praying with her mind, or you might say with her heart, but she was not really vocalizing the words. That's legitimate. That's not an attitude of prayer, that's prayer. God knows our minds, He knows our hearts, and He knows every word, every thought that we form with those words, whether they're silent or whether they're vocalized. We cannot be praying. It is impossible to be praying, silently or orally, unceasingly. Now, somebody says, okay, Jim, I see your point, but I don't understand why you make it. This is not the deity of Christ. This is not the vicarious atonement of our Lord on the cross or the resurrection or any of the fundamentals of the faith. So you're taking up a lot of airtime, it seems to me, to make up a small point. Here's the problem. When people, albeit well-meaning, get up and they're not intentionally, I think, dishonest with the Scriptures, but they misrepresent their own prayer habits in that way, they're not only deceiving themselves, but they're laying a burden, a hurtful burden, on other people's conscience who listen to them and take them seriously, and they think somehow that's what I ought to be doing, and they constantly feel frustrated and they feel defeated. When they cannot rise to that, they're told they ought to pray, they feel they'll be better Christians if they do pray, they feel like they're defective Christians if they don't, but when they do pray, they just cannot manage to bring themselves to this unceasing standard, defined as a 24/7 attitude of prayer, or just make it 16/7. You can't do that either. So I just like to knock that thing in the head, because maybe you haven't, but in my growing up years, in the years of my training in seminary and since, I have sometimes heard that. There's a silliness there that is hurtful. And so if you've heard that, I hope I can disabuse your mind of it. If any of you are laboring under that or having a guilty conscience, because you're very serious, you're very earnest, and you want to be a man or woman of prayer, and you feel like you're being a deficient prayer warrior if you can't manage that. So what does it mean, Jim? It simply means to pray regularly, to pray regularly. Paul is saying, I pray unceasingly for you. I pray regularly. When I pray, I mention you in my prayers. That's a simple idea. That's all in the world that he means. Now, in verse 10, he's making a request of God, if perhaps now at last, in the will of God, I may succeed to come to you. It reminds us that divine priorities had been setting Paul's agenda all along. What's good for him is good for us. Man proposes, as the saying goes, but God disposes. Calvin says we may take this to mean that the Lord employed him in more urgent business, which he could not have neglected without damage to the church. Everything with this man, and he is a benchmark for us. He's the standard bearer for us apart from our Lord Jesus Christ. And what he did and where he went and what he said was directed always by the will of God. It wasn't his place to say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and make a plan and I'm not going to deviate from it, unless it's stacked up with the will of God. So many of our problems, so many of the complications in life that we have are because we limit the scope of what we're willing to submit to the will of God. We make plans to go here, to move there, to buy this, to sell that, to attend this school, or to leave this school and go to that school, to start a business, to sell a business, to expand a business, or to enter another profession. We do so many of these things under our own lights, and we bring into our lives so many unnecessary complications because, unlike Paul and his discharge of the Lord's business, we do not fully understand that we are God's servants, first of all, that God is not our servant, he is our sovereign, and that wherever we are, whatever we do, whatever our employment, our vocations, our avocations, or whatever, they're all to be submitted to the scrutiny of the will of God. I've complained about this for years, and rightfully so. We are so acculturated that we just can't get it, even when the pastor says it, we just can't get it. But we're working with a corporation, and we think we're its slave. The corporation announces one day that, hey, you're in Pittsburgh, you're going to New York. Oh, I am? Or you're going to Atlanta, or you're going to Cincinnati, or you're going to Denver, or you're in Portland and you're going to Seattle. Be there in 3 days. Now, folks, I do understand all this. I do understand we have jobs. We've got to keep those jobs. And if we say, well, no, I'm not. We're here. We like it here. The kids like it here. We have good schools here. My wife wants to stay here. We've got a great church here, et cetera, et cetera. My point is that before we let corporations commandeer our lives, there needs to be a space in there where we bring these things before God and we say, no, we're not going that way, and let the company drop their jaws. Now, you may lose that job, but that's living radically. Way back when I was in seminary, this is kind of a stock story for me on this point, I was attending the First Baptist Church of Dallas. The pastor was the famed W.A. Criswell. And what great days those were. There was in that church, I'm sure he's long dead by now, because he was quite a bit older than I at the time. I was barely in my early 20s. But there was a man whom I greatly admired by the name of Braz Pryor. I'm not really sure what his exact position was there in Texas, but I remember Dr. Criswell telling the story himself. He had been promoted by General Motors, I believe it was, one of the big auto companies, but I'm certain it was General Motors, been promoted to the headquarters there. And in preparation for the move, Brad dared to ask God for his will. And he went to Detroit, and he looked around and looked at everything that one would normally look at to see if this would really be a propitious move for he and his family. And one of the things that he looked at were churches. Now, I'm quite sure that in the time he was there, he could not investigate all the churches in Detroit at that time, and there were probably some good ones that he didn't know about or overlooked. But in the providence of God, where he looked, he didn't find anything that in his mind compared to the First Baptist Church of Dallas. His family was ensconced there, helped there, growing there, and he believed, for their spiritual needs, That's where they ought to stay. And bless his heart, he did the radical thing. He told General Motors no. Well, people even told me at that time that that was a career buster, and I'm sure it probably was. However, I was not around there long enough to know how that played out, but it didn't matter. What mattered was that he had the spirit of the Apostle Paul, who says here in verse 11, there's something I really want to do. I want to see you. In my prayers, I'm making request. If perhaps now, God had not allowed him to so far, now at last, by the will of God, I may succeed in coming to you. He could have gotten a passage on a ship. It was easy, relatively, for people to get around in the Roman world in those days. Paul traveled extensively. He was cosmopolitan. But he wasn't going to Rome as much as he wanted to go there and do what he's talking about if it weren't agreeable to the Spirit of God. Now, some people, I guess, just assume that that applies only to ministers. Folks, that doesn't just apply to shepherds. That applies to all the sheep. So when you're thinking of buying or not buying, I mean making some significant purchase, check in with the will of God. When you're thinking about moving or not moving, check in with the will of God and do the radical thing. We had a fellow in our church, a young fellow, former baseball player, had a job, and the company told him that they were going to move him somewhere down in California. Well, frankly, he had just been saved, and his wife was a new Christian, and they loved it here, and they loved the church. His wife was panicked. They absolutely did not want to leave. So they went before the Lord, and they just put the whole proposition before him. Is this what we're to do? And in praying, things so worked out that the company went through some changes and decided to keep him here, and he is still in our midst. Folks, you never know. Live radically. Pull out the stops and live recklessly for Christ and submit everything to the will of God. When you go to send your kids to school, pray about that matter. When you're going to locate in a city, pray about that matter. Live adventuresomely. It's a great thing to be able to have that access to go before the throne of grace and to say, Heavenly Father, I know so little. You know everything. You see the end from the beginning and all things in between. I know that wherever you send me, everything may not be hunky-dory. That's not the standard. All I want to know is what you want me to do. The only place I want to be is where you want me and my family, if you have a family, to be. I want to be directed by you in all things. That's the standard set for us by the Apostle Paul, and we ought to emulate that. And my goodness, the blessings that come from living that way. Don't just let Acme Corporation, that's a made-up name. There may be an Acme Corporation, but that's not what I'm referring to. Don't let Acme Corporation lead you and your family around the country by the nose. You may be better off staying. You may be better off with another job rather than that job. You say, man, that's radical. Friend, it is radical. And that's the way we come to get to know God, by living radically. So Paul continues in verse 11 and 12. He tells the Roman church, very personal terms, I long to see you. Here's why. I want to impart some spiritual gift to you. God has given me grace so that I might do that. I want you to be established. I want you to be rooted. It's not that they aren't established already. He means in this context more firmly rooted. But he amplifies on what he means. I want to be encouraged. I don't want you to think this is a one-way street. He says, I want to be encouraged together with you while I'm among you. Each of us, mutual thing, encouraged by the other's faith, both yours and mine. It's noteworthy to me that his desire to visit the Christians in Rome was motivated by a sense of mutual dependency. That's remarkable for this reason. Paul was an apostle, yet he felt he needed the stimulation of his fellow saints as much as they needed his. And that perspective is wholly consistent with the metaphor of the church as the body and its members in their interdependency. It is this attribute of body life which lends significance to admonitions like Hebrews 10:25. Do not forsake the assembling of yourself together, as the manner of some is. Hear me. Community with other believers, folks, is a vital feature of the divine blueprint for stabilizing and enriching our faith. Dear friends, I know that some of my listeners, for one reason or another, not because you're sick or disabled, there is that, but because somewhere along the line you got hurt or whatever, and you decided that you wanted no part of the institutional church. Listen, Christ established it, my dear friends. Christ's establishment, it's His. And He established it for your good and for those others around you. You need it, and they need you. Don't ever forget that. That's the way God designed the church. John Wesley said, Christianity is a social religion. You make it solitary and you'll kill it. And you may do a lot of killing of yourself as well, spiritually. You need the stimulation of others, and others need your stimulation. You kill it because you cut off its members from the vital mutual supply necessary to maintain the health of the body. Now listen carefully to me. The Lone Ranger believer who feels so spiritually independent that he or she thinks they can thrive spiritually without the fellowship of the body is one, and I say this lovingly, but frankly, one whose arrogance is only exceeded by his or her ignorance. If no less than the Apostle Paul felt the fellowship of the Roman Church would be a gift or boon to his own spiritual life, who am I to pretend that I am self-sufficient? Such self-sufficiency is a notorious landmark of great spiritual deficiency. Now, he says, one reason I want to come there is to impart some spiritual gift to you. Some people have thought that's some second work of grace, as though Paul hoped to impart some fundamental spiritual power which the folk in Rome were still wanting. But verse 12 indicates that what he had in mind, rather, was that edification, that is the expected and normal result of shared faith operating in love and according to the unique gifts in each believer. And I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that often I plan to come to you. I mean, I plan to, but I've been prevented thus far by the providence of God, he means. I plan to come to you in order that I might obtain some fruit among you also, even as among the rest of the Gentiles. This note reminds us of the tendency of people to take offense and to misunderstand even the best intentions. Reminds us that tendency is as ancient as society itself. Satan loves to leverage that natural tendency to take offense when somebody we expected to come and see us doesn't, or something like that. Satan leverages that to sow seeds of discord among the brethren. The wise pastor has to try to understand human nature, try to anticipate the breeding grounds of trouble, and that can be dicey. Paul did not want any believers in Rome to feel slighted by his failure to visit there. It had not been for lack of personal desire, he assures them, but rather because of precluding circumstances. Those include one principle driving his missionary agenda. It's mentioned in chapter 15, verses 20 and 22. I've always aspired to preach the gospel, not where Christ was already named, as it was in Rome, that I might not build upon another man's foundation. For this reason, I've often been hindered from coming to you. When he says, even as among the rest of the Gentiles, this clause, along with verse 5, make it fairly conclusive that Paul regards the Roman church as a Gentile entity primarily, whatever the extent of its Jewish minority constituency. Well, dear friends, thank you for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.